it's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 17th of March 2012. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 17th of March, Sharon Brown talked to Dawn Jeffrey from the Steiner Kindergarten about their harvest fair. She spoke to Nio from Waiheke Library, Green MP Denise Roach, and Hugh Ross from Forest and Bird about the Denniston Plateau BioBlitz.
Here we are, first of all, with Dawn. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, Sharon. Good morning.
Good morning. And so, tell us, how's it all going, the preparations for the Steiner Fair,
is it? It's going absolutely fantastic. Yeah, the Harvest Fair is on Sunday the 1st of April from 10 until 2. It's quite an auspicious day. It is April Fool's and also the day that we turn our clocks back. Yeah, but no, all the organisation has just been incredible. We've got an amazing team of parents, some really talented people, and everything's going really well, getting quite exciting at this point.
Lovely, great. And are there any highlights or things that are different this year?
There are so many highlights, so I hope I've got time to talk about them all. But why don't we start with the music? We have an incredible lineup of music on the day, and what is really lovely is a lot of these musicians are actual parents of the children at the kindergarten. So we've got Sol Harris, Steve Edwards, Ian Simpson, and Aaron Carpenter with Mojo Rises.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and then we've also got Andy Lewis coming along and Kerry Eriwata.
Great.
Yeah, so they'll be on the stage, which is just across from the pond, the other side of the pond. So we're kind of spreading things out a little bit more this year, so there's a bit more room.
Oh, so Dawn, as a multitasking mother, is currently trying to open lollipops while she talks on the radio. I think it's Sod's Law that when you've actually got something else to do, the kids get really noisy. I think they can spot it, can't they?
As soon as you get on the phone.
Yeah. They come running over. Okay, kids, you need to be a bit quiet, but do you want to say hello quickly on the radio?
Would you like to say hello, Poppy?
Yeah?
Come here, love.
Okay, so come over and say who you are.
Right. And
I'm Flint, and I'm on Waiheke Radio.
Oh, lovely.
I'm Poppy on Waiheke Radio.
Lovely.
Excellent. Well, good job, guys.
All right.
Good. And so anyway, back to the Harvest Fair. Of course, it's all about children, so so it's all good. Yeah.
Wow. The Waiheke community, once again, has been incredible with supporting us with prizes and donations for our auctions and raffles. We're doing something a little bit different with one of them this year. We're actually making a Trade Me auction. We've got an incredible package together. We're calling the Waiheke Winter Escape, and that's going up on Trade Me in the next couple of days. So we'll put that link on our website, www.fossilbaykindergarten.org, and we'll also put it on our Facebook page so Waiheke people can tap into that. But it's going to be, you know, spreading out nationally. And that package is going to be one night at the Luxury Artia's Chalet by the Sea, a ferry pickup, a dual massage, so two people having massage same time, champagne, organic breakfast, and dinner for two at Mudbrick.
Oh, okay. Where are they staying? Sorry?
Artia's Chalet by the Sea.
Oh, is that a new place?
It's not new. One of our parents, Fiona, it's her business, and they've got
like
a website. Check it out; it's
something.
Incredible. Oh no, it's luxury, beautiful accommodation.
Okay, yeah, lovely,
yeah.
Good.
So yeah, we're doing that one on a Trade Me auction, and the rest of them will be blind auctions. So you can go to the table on the day and have a look and make bids for the ones you're interested. We've also got another.
Any highlights there?
Yeah, we've got another night's accommodation at the Le Chalet in Oneroa, and that's combined with dinner at Delight Turkish Cafe. ZB's creative package for children includes a holiday program, workshops, art pack, and music lessons. So that'd be a lovely one for your child. We've got mum and dad pampering packs, including beauty treatments with Annabelle's, therapeutic massage by Natalie Davis, and Synergy Body and at Synergy, and Body and Soul and Waiheke Soap Company products. We've got loads of wine coming from Man of War, Passage Rock, Cable Bay. We've got a four-hour handyman package. That would be a really nice one. Yes, I'll be bidding for that one if I can.
Great.
Yeah. James Samuel, he's going to offer some social media work. There's so much. I could just go on and on. Yeah.
Oh, well, look, it sounds brilliantly organised, and you've got amazing prizes and stuff.
We have.
And the usual with lovely jams and cakes.
Yes. Yep, the stalls. We've got the craft stall, plants and seedlings, produce, cakes, secondhand children's clothes, toys. We'll have the heaviest pumpkin and marrow competition.
Great. So where's this money all going then?
The money is all going into our fundraising account, which this year is going to pay for a new porch outside the kindergarten. So your children were at Fossil Bay. Yep. I don't know if you remember that where the children actually come into the rooms, it's a paved area and it's a little bit unlevel, and it's kind of an area prone to the odd accident. So what we'd like to do is build a lovely new timber porch. Mm. Yeah, so okay. It's a really good.
So this is the backside or the front side
where
onto
you actually
the
enter into the
okay,
into the
gate
kindergarten
into
rooms. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, look, it sounds really great. And yes, well, and can you just do a quick plug for the times on it?
Yeah, so it's from 10 until 2. There'll be FPOST available. If it's raining, which it won't be, somehow or another we'll move to Te Huruhi Hall.
That should be interesting.
Yeah, I'm not going to go there too much.
Yeah.
Something else I would like to mention is that we're going to have some free workshops, all within the theme of harvest. We're going to have Richard Everett from the Waiheke Honey Company. He's going to be talking about beekeeping. Helen Alscott from Herbal Health Waiheke, she's going to do a weed walk. Dawn Perkins is going to be talking about keeping hens. Pete Russell from Uvi talking about local food systems. And a couple more. So they're free
great
talks. Come along and enjoy.
So is the program going to be up somewhere so that if people wanted to time their visit for the talks, they'll be
able
to see
them? Yeah, they're on our Facebook page and on our website as well. Yeah.
Great. So if people do a search for Fossil Bay, it should come up.
Yes, no problem
great
at all.
Yeah. Okay, well, Dawn, all the very best for that. Sounds amazing.
Thanks, Sharon.
And
and
good on you for organising it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Great. Good. So I can hear the children are running riot outside. They haven't trashed the radio station yet, but it's only a matter of minutes.
That's right.
Okay, lovely. Well, a little
Waiheke Radio.
Hiya, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
You've done this before, so we're straight into it.
Yeah, that's right. Ah, they're quite rambunctious, aren't they?
Yes. Well, children all over, eh?
That's right.
Unless you're around them all the time, you forget. I find my kids like, you know, you think you've exhausted them by 7 o'clock at night and you've been doing stuff all day and you just need to have a sit down, and they're still like, you know, jumping up and down on the tramp and it's amazing how much energy they have.
I know. Where did that go?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's two things that I wanted to briefly talk about today. We want to talk about Zoomow, which I think Di has been on to talk about already. I just wanted to remind people that if you are planning to come to the event,
what's going on?
It would be really great if you could come into the library and just let us know, just for numbers in terms of catering and all of that.
Lovely. Can you just remind us what that event is about?
Okay, so Zoomow is the One Island, One Book event, which is to do with New Zealand Book Month, which is just an amazing month, really. Books change lives and everything. You've probably seen those ads on TV.
When does that start? Or are we in Book Month
we
now?
We are in Book Month now.
So it's the month of March?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So the event that we're having is on the 28th, and we're trying to get as many people as possible on the island to read this one book called Zoomow by Mark Sweet. So he's coming along on the 28th to have a chat with us. I think that's from 7 till 9 p.m., which is on a Wednesday, I think. So it'll be a great event. It was great last year. I'm sure it will be fantastic this year as well. And to accompany that event, we're also having a Tai Chi session on Saturday, the 24th. So that will be the Saturday before.
Lovely. And so why has this particular book been chosen?
We like to choose a recent publication. We were sort of tossing up between, I think it was about three books, but this one was one that we could get a lot more copies of. The other one turned out to be published independently. So it didn't really, even though it was great, didn't really suit trying to get as many people to read it. But we didn't choose... Well, it has to be a New Zealand author. That's just the main thing. But we didn't really choose it for any particular qualities because we hadn't read it yet. But it's actually really good. It's a really good book. But they do Tai Chi in the book, and it's a major theme throughout, which is why we decided to do a session. And Helga's going to take that on Saturday.
I love library events. I love the way they sort of integrate other things that you do with the books. And,
yes.
And you know, reading, which I've always thought of as being quite a solitary activity becomes quite a social activity. It's really nice.
It's funny how that easily goes together. You know, if you think about book clubs or something like that where you're discussing a book, you've all read it separately, but you get other things from it by talking about it. Yeah, so that's really great. And you can download that ebook from kobobooks.com if you don't have time to get a copy, because I think they're all booked out now. But you can buy that from the bookshops on the island as well.
Lovely, great.
And the only other thing I wanted to briefly talk about today was a new promotion through the libraries called Launch Your Lyrics, which has already started, but it finishes on May the 16th, so you've got heaps of time. And basically, it's a competition that's going to be judged by Rodney Fisher from Goodshirt, and you need to write your own lyrics. And it's open for 11 to 14 years and 15 to 18 years, so two different categories there. And first prize will be a recording session at Zeal Music Studios, where you'll get to record your winning lyrics. And if you want any more information on that, you just go to our website at aucklandlibraries.gov.nz.
Lovely. So that's the Launch Your Lyrics, running from March the 12th to May the 16th, and you can do it all online.
Yeah.
Great. It sounds amazing. That sounds like a treat. So you don't need the music, you just need the lyrics.
That's right.
Great. Yeah. Oh, even I could do that.
I know. Unfortunately, we're too old.
Oh, right. Okay. Whoops, I missed that. Yes, 11 to 14
years.
And 15 to 18. Oh, okay. Right. Lovely. Okay, well, thanks so much for coming in. That's fabulous.
That's all right. Have a good St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you. Denise Roche, Green MP, is with us now.
Hiya.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Okay, well, Denise, you're standing down from the local board.
Yep, I resigned February. I didn't resign before then because I didn't want to trigger the by-election during the summer period so that people have actually got a real chance to campaign while they're not being distracted by the busy tourist season.
Great. And so... what do you think? We're going to start our election interviews just after this. So what do you think are the main challenges now facing the candidates?
Well, I think the main challenge is actually getting the vote out, really. The by-elections usually return a quite low voting result, and local board, local body elections have traditionally returned a lower vote than the general elections as well. And in fact, the general elections this year, it was the lowest turnout since 1877. So we're lucky. We live in a community that's actually quite engaged. So there's the opportunity for these candidates to get out there and get the vote up and get people interested and engaged in what's going on with the local board. And I hope they will. There's a vast opportunity for them to get some stuff done if they do get elected.
Mm. Can I just ask you, I mean, the transition to the super city, do you have any, you worked under a local board that was pre-super city and sort of post-super city. Has that changed the dynamics of the local board, or is it a successful transition in terms of the way things work, or is it pretty much business as usual and the local board sort of works in a similar way, has similar challenges?
My experience of the local board, my 15 months that I was on it, as compared to the Waiheke Community Board, which was under Auckland City Council, is that the workload was extreme. The timeframes that were insisted upon by the legislation which came through with the Super City laws which created the super city, were just so tight. So there were all sorts of, you know, 3-year plans, 1-year plans, plans for this, that and the other. We're currently doing the waste minimisation plans. So it was kind of like, and a review of all the policy as well. So it's kind of like you're having sort of like 3 years work being pushed into 6 months. And I don't think some of the newer board members kind of got it very well. And it may settle down a bit, but I don't know. What I'm seeing is that the board has got more opportunities, I think, to take control and to be a stronger advocate at council level. But I'm in two minds about whether that's actually happening.
Because, I mean, I don't know, but it seems that it's still just as difficult to prevail on what happens at Auckland Council as it ever was. I mean, I just notice all the back and forth on the curbing and channelling. Yeah. And is that because the local board maybe needs to take a stronger leadership role in that area and sort of demand more control over how the resources are spent? Or is that just because it's so difficult to find out who you need to talk to be able to get things done?
Bit of both, really. But I think this is also the result of the super city structure, where they set up the transport sector into a council-controlled organisation. So it's not directly accountable to the elected officials. And so I think that's created another layer of bureaucracy. It's taken 15 months for the transport CCO to come to say, right, well, we're not going to do that unless the local board tells us to. And I mean, it was meeting after meeting after meeting where we asked, demanded, passed resolutions for the local board to be told in advance of what the work program was so that we could keep an eye on it. And now, finally, they've come back and said, oh, to people in the community who are concerned about curbing and channelling, no, we're not going to do that unless the local board takes an active role in advocacy around it. So a bit of a buck passing there. One bureaucracy is saying, you know, pass the buck. We'll pass it to the elected officials and they can cop the flak.
Which is interesting because the messages I've had from the elected officials has been that we need to talk to people in Auckland Transport. Back and forth.
Yeah. And what happens is that people get horrendously crossed and disengaged from the process. That's what happens, is that when elected officials behave like that and the bureaucrats are also behaving like that, people just zone out and say, well, what's the bloody point?
Well, it's quite interesting because I did actually make a submission on the waste minimisation plan because I did feel it was important, but I have to say I resented the whole process of it and I was really annoyed and felt really disengaged because I felt that I was saying things that had been said over and over and over and over again, and that Waiheke had been leading the way in all of those areas that they're now talking about having an interest in, and somehow I have to do it all again.
Yeah. Are you doing a verbal submission?
No, I didn't. I suppose I could call them up and do one.
I'm doing mine on Monday.
Oh, are you? Yeah. Oh, well, maybe I should.
I actually sent in one of those postcards that the Waiheke Resource Trust did, but I put on it, I want to be heard. And then I think they went, oh, my God, it's a Green MP.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe I do want, I don't know, do I want to be heard? I'm like, they haven't heard me thus far. But yes, I suppose maybe I'll make an effort, and it's probably too late now.
But I would encourage people to do verbal submissions because you do have the ability to tell the stories, and the stories are very, very powerful for politicians, certainly the politicians at council level anyway.
I might just send my daughter along to jump up and down and say, you're not listening to me, you're not listening to me, listen to me. I think that would probably be, you know, pretty effective. Okay, so, well, Denise, thanks very much for all your work on the board, both in this form and the form it had before. And fab, because it hasn't always been easy.
No, and I think actually, when I think about it, there were a few things that I kind of got involved with, and I said in my valedictory, one of the reasons why I said in December that I'd resign at the next election, thinking it would be January, but it was actually February, but because I wanted to do a valedictory. And one of the things I said was that I took no credit for any of the achievements because they were always joint achievements. And those are things like the Matiatia getting it recognised as the Urapar, and you know, the whole super city campaign that we all ran, all those sorts of things. So the last 15 months on that board, I think, was not my most effective, and I'm just so heartened to be able to actually kick a bit of stuff around as a central government politician.
Mm, great. Okay, so moving on to Ports of Auckland, which is part of the central part of your workload, I suppose, as Green MP, because that's your part of your portfolio, dealing with Labour issues. Can you just give us a brief outline of where we're at with that?
Okay, so the... Right. We were up to is that, and we'll just recap a bit, so the Ports of Auckland workers are represented by the Maritime Workers Union, the majority of them are. They started negotiating their collective contract last year. The contract negotiations have been fraught. There have been quite a few major issues around contracting out, and some of the staff were contracted out in the middle of last year, and that was quite a big dispute. So what happens there is that a private employer comes in and basically forces the wages down in order to make a profit. Contracting out was not mentioned at all and was not part of the contract negotiations until it became obvious that the port didn't want to settle the contract at all. They made a call for further flexibility around rostering, which was met by the union. They said, that's fine. We know in 6 months in advance what the ships are coming in. We can change the rosters and we can extend hours or reduce hours, but we're not going to have complete flexibility where people don't know what they're rostered on, which I think is fair and reasonable, because families and of the workers need to know what they're...
And they also had a mix of casual staff, permanent staff and temporary staff, didn't they? So given the fact that ships don't just arrive from one night to the next and you don't know when they're coming, you have a certain level of flexibility that you can work around what your port needs are.
And in terms of their rosters as well, the full-time workers would have one guaranteed day off per week, which would be up there on the roster, and the other day off would be a floating day, depending on needs, if people had fallen off sick or whatever. So there was quite a lot of flexibility there anyway. There was, during the course of the negotiations over the summer, there was a paper that was leaked, which came from the company, which had stressed that there would be the opportunity to contract out and make them all redundant and contract it out to a private company. And the company at that time denied it. They said, oh, that was just an idea that we were kicking around. But as it turned out, they made the workers, or they said that they would be, while they were still in negotiation, they said that they would be contracting out, and they were started to call for expressions of interest from stevedoring companies. They started advertising in Australia. They started advertising on the radio for people to fill positions, all of which shows a really clear indication of bad faith bargaining. So where it's got to at the moment was the workers went on strike, because there's some issues around employment law when you go on strike about job protection. And then the employer decided to start the contracting out process anyway.
Which is in fact illegal.
It's illegal to make them redundant while they're on strike. But I'm not terribly clear, so I can't talk with absolute authority on that, but there are some legal issues around that. And so as well as pursuing what I'd call a hearts and mind campaign with the Maritime Workers Union and the Council of Trade Unions, there has been an industrial strategy which involves the international unions coming into play as well, and there's also been a legal strategy. So the industrial strategy has kicked in. There's been pickets in Sydney. There's been some talk of blacking ships. So ship owners don't particularly want to go to places that have got industrial disputes in case it does have an ongoing effect on their other ports that they have to call in. And so there's, so that's been one of the reasons why there's been fewer ships coming in to Tauranga, is because they don't want to actually get a bad reputation, those shipping lines.
Mm. So can I just ask the latest developments in terms of the council? We think of the council as being slightly left-leaning. Len Brown is head of the council.
No,
and
it's not left-leaning. It's never been left-leaning.
Okay.
Okay, so part of the problem is you know how we talked about the transport agency with the local board issue. We've got a similar problem with CCOs and the Ports of Auckland. Ports of Auckland is owned by the council essentially, but it's two steps away from the elected officials. So there's a board, and that board reports to the Auckland Council Investment Limited, which is a CCO, which was set up under the Super City, where all the directors were appointed by Rodney Hyde and his mates, who got rid of the only board members on the Ports of Auckland board who actually had some kind of communication and relationship with the Maritime Workers Union. So it's the Auckland Council Investment Limited that reports to the council. We've never tested so far the powers of the mayor, and if you remember about the Super City, there was that whole thing about the mayor has got executive powers, which is an unusual and the first time this has happened in New Zealand. And I think that was written into the law because they're expecting John Banks to be the mayor. But they got Len Brown, who has been a Labour Party supporter. However, it's not a left-leaning council because there's only about, that you could say, there's only probably about 7 out of the 20 that...
Oh, right. I thought it was higher than that. I haven't been following it.
No.
Okay.
And people keep saying this. They keep expecting
it. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how things become myths. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's basically because that's where Len Brown had been perceived, that he was a lefty. But...
Yeah, it's difficult. Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting, just being sort of a member of the public, is that the Ports of Auckland is 100% council-owned, and yet the council is now saying that they've had legal advice suggesting that they shouldn't get involved with the dispute, and they don't have a right to comment on the dispute. And it seems, you know... Even in private industry, if you know, I think Brian Rudman also pointed it out, this notion of if Nike has a problem with its subsidiary company, Nike is responsible and takes steps to rectify it. So it's interesting that the council almost seems to be abdicating responsibility, especially at a moral level, to deal with this issue.
My comment on that would be is that you get the legal advice you pay for, don't you?
Mm.
So I don't believe that it's terribly independent advice, and the executive powers of the mayor have not been tested. And I think that was the point that Kathy Casey was making. And I would suggest that because it's a new the Auckland Council and the laws that set up the Auckland Council is a brand new set of laws, and it should be tested. And so I think the legal advice is quite timorous.
Mm.
And if you think about what's happened in the last couple of days with the Ports of Auckland, there's been an injunction that they'd put on, that they'd lodged with the Employment High Court?
Employment Court, yeah.
Employment Court, basically saying that they needed to have the redundancies, you know, that they couldn't issue redundancy notices, and that has been accepted as an interim injunction. And there was some capitulation, if you like, or some concessions that were put through from the ports management around that. And from my point of view, that's the ports accepting good legal advice, which is if we don't do that, then we're stuffed. But what my experience of the council was that you could get two sets of legal advice on anything, because essentially they're paying for the result they want. And we've seen this time and time again in terms of reports to council. We saw it with the waste issue, for example, with Mike McQuillan demanding the outcome of reports and research before it had been completed.
Mm.
The same thing happens. And
so what is the cost? What is the cost of this whole dispute? Sacking workers while they're on strike, etc., etc.
Ports of Auckland suggest that they will save $6 million a year by contracting out staff, I don't think it's $6 million a year. It's $6 million over a certain amount of time. I'm not clear in my head what it is. But there's also been bandied about that in terms of redundancy pay, that will cost $11 million. In terms of wanting to increase the profit margin to 12%, that's going to have a huge impact on that. The thing is that you don't get any increase in your profit margin from the asset, because the asset is there and it belongs to the people of Auckland, unless you partially privatise it, which we have avoided so far, but that's the model in Tauranga. And I suspect that there is a privatisation agenda out. First privatise the workers and then privatise or partially privatise the asset, which would fit nicely with the national government strategy of mixed ownership model for assets. So I don't believe that the 12% is achievable, and that was the figure that came through to the Auckland Council Investment Limited, which was then passed by Auckland Council last year. But I think they were sold a pup, and I doubt very much whether it's achievable through just reducing the wages and conditions of the workers. What is achievable, how it could be achievable, though, is by putting up the prices of the shipping companies. And they have managed to avoid being part of the Commerce Act. They're exempt from the Commerce Act, which means that they can act in an anti-competitive and a manner, like a cartel, in order to fix prices. And they negotiate very strongly with the other ports in New Zealand, basically to force prices down. But if you look in terms of productivity for the ports, Auckland currently is, their last rate of return was 6%. Tauranga, which has the contracted out workforce, which has a partially privatised asset, reached 6.3%.
Right, so it's all smoke and mirrors to a degree.
It's ideology. Mm. It's actually ideology.
And so why should the Auckland public be concerned? Why should we be defending, from your point of view, ports of the workers at ports of Auckland?
There's a couple of reasons. One is that what we're seeing in the industrial climate at the moment, and we're seeing it with the ports of Auckland, is there's a hard line approach coming through from employers, and you can see this too with the lockout of the AFCO meat workers, and that issue is around casualisation as well. You've seen the Oceania workers, which are rest home workers. They don't take strike action very easily whatsoever. They're going on strike because they've been offered a 1% increase, which doesn't even take them up to covering the cost of living increases. And 600 of those workers are earning $13.61 an hour, which is 11 cents above the minimum wage. So what I'm seeing is a race to the bottom. I'm seeing an erosion of wages and conditions. And when you tie that into the welfare reforms that the government has just announced, where they're going to be trying to force people into finding work, you're going to find a whole bunch of undercutting going on between low-paid workers and those beneficiaries who are being forced off the benefits into them. So that means it's an employer's market. It means that they can actually treat workers with a lack of respect, if you like, around their pays and conditions.
Mm. What I continue to find really interesting is people who say, oh, well, their conditions are so good, therefore we should whittle away their conditions, rather than saying, well, this is, a council-controlled organisation, therefore it should be setting the standards of employment practice, which are then matched by other ports, rather than whittling away their conditions.
Absolutely. I mean, the health and safety issues are just one aspect of a workforce that's actually engaged and respected. One of the there's been some economic advice just came out quite recently, which says that in high-risk industries, which is what ports work is, you need an active, engaged workforce who are very, very aware of what's going on and participate in their health and safety, for example. What you've seen in Tauranga is 3 deaths since they were contracted out. The other thing I think is that's so, it's so narrow-minded to think that, you're better off than me, so get stuffed. Well, actually, you're better off than me, and I want to be like you.
That's right, and we should all be aspiring to protect. I mean, if you haven't got decent wage rights, you spend a lot of your day actually at work.
That's right, 4 jobs or whatever to where you used to do 2. And this is what's happening in Australia. Australia has got, in the workforce there, a much higher density of union membership and union collective bargaining, which means that the wages and conditions are much higher. We're still suffering from what happened in 1991 with the Employment Contracts Act. And so what we should be doing is saying, and I've said it myself, that if the wharfies fall, all of us fall.
Mm.
Because what it does mean, it means for collective bargaining for unions, it's actually going to mean that there's a downgrading right across the board of wages and conditions. That's why I'm the industrial relations spokesperson, and that's why I'm supporting them, and why I've been supporting the meat workers, and why I've been on the picket line with the Oceania rest home workers, and I will be again on Monday as well.
And can I just ask then, what is the public to do as a concerned citizen, if they are concerned?
One of the things they can be doing is they can be writing to the council to say we demand that we don't contract out these jobs. They can be writing to the Ports of Auckland Chief Executive Tony Gibson and saying the same, and the board. We could be lobbying politicians, central government politicians, and saying we want you to back off, basically, because I think underlying all this is the government's agenda, which is to squeeze as much out of the low wage economy as they possibly can by driving wages down further. New Zealand research shows that if you're in a union, you actually earn 20% more than anybody who's not in a union in the same job.
And talking again actually about Australian unions, I couldn't believe it. I worked for a while in Australia, and it was just so easy. You went in and signed your contract, and it was all completely transparent. You have this experience, you get this much money, and I couldn't believe how much money I made actually as a teacher there. It was just all really laid out. I didn't have to get into some sort of personal wrangling with the boss. And everyone was getting the same. It was just such a pleasure to have all of that sorted out. I mean, I know that their employment rights are also getting whittled away, but still, it just did seem so much better.
Yeah, well, they've actually done quite well at maintaining union membership, and that's where New Zealand hasn't. And we had a Labor government for 9 years after the Employment Contracts Act. To their credit, they repealed the Employment Contracts Act, which broke down bargaining into their individual-based bargaining a lot of the time. But it didn't go. What Labor did didn't go far enough to actually address the decline in wages and conditions.
Mm.
And in fact, when they instituted the Working for Families benefit to shore up low-income families who were in the workforce, what they were doing was saying to the employers, "Well, you know, carry on paying low wages, and we'll subsidise you." I admit there needed to be something done about poverty, but we didn't go far enough.
Mm. Well, Denise, thanks very much for coming in and clarifying some of the issues around that.
Cool.
The other thing, of course, is that the Maritime Union does have lots of information on the strike and what's going on, and pictures of last week's demonstration.
Yep.
What was that like?
Oh, it was fantastic, actually. I thought there were about 10,000 people there because I was in the middle of it. But it, certainly down at the rally at the other end, there were about 3,000, and I think a whole bunch of people had dropped off because it was a 2 kilometre walk and very slow. But it was amazing. There's a 24-hour picket down there as well, and you can go down any time. Make yourself known to the. They've got a roster.
Okay, where is that? I might go down and have a look.
It's down at Teal Park, so it's the gateway. It's on the start of Tamaki Drive.
Okay, fine.
And it's they've got. There's a couple of tents there. It's going 24 hours. They've got executive and delegates on every shift. The workers are also saying, because they're all a bit bored, you know, they're doing community work with schools and Marae, because basically they're just hanging around, and it's a bit demoralising. But you can also donate to the cause, which I think is on their Facebook page. The Australian Maritime Union's donating $100,000 to ensure that they don't suffer. This is a bit different from the 1951 classic lockout, where actually it was illegal to feed or help any striker or any locked out workers.
Incredible.
Yeah, we're not that far away from it, though.
Yeah. Okay, well, Denise, that was Denise Roche, Green MP, talking about the Ports of Auckland. and the situation down there with the people who've been forced out of their jobs, really.
Yeah, they're on the picket line.
Yeah.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Hugh has turned up, and he was at the BioBlitz in Denniston, which was an event held two weekends ago to work out what plants and animals make the Denniston Plateau unique as part of a response to a resource management hearing where the hearing came out that approving the mining of Denniston and approving mining on Denniston and saying that there was no reason not to approve it because they weren't sure of what kind of biodiversity there was up on the hill. Right, hi Hugh.
Hi Sharon.
Great. So, why did you end up going to the BioBlitz?
Well, I guess a number of issues. So, I think Denniston's a fascinating subject, not only because of its environmental credentials, but also because it represents the beginning of a tsunami of mining in New Zealand. And so there was an opportunity for volunteers to go to Denniston and be involved with a lot of other people who are really passionate about the environment and passionate about saving this intact biodiversity from the pillaging.
Mm. So this BioBlitz was organised by Forest and Bird. The Denniston mining on the Denniston Plateau is one of their major campaigns for this year. So can you tell us what you actually had to do on the BioBlitz?
Well, essentially, as a result of the resource consent hearing coming out in favour of the mining application for 200 hectares, there were a couple of shortfallings or failures in the application to prevent that happening. One of those was that there was insufficient understanding of the outstanding biodiversity of this area to actually prove the case. And so as a result of ongoing opposition, i.e. right now Forest and Bird in Environment Court with Bathurst to appeal the consent, there's an attempt to fully audit the biodiversity of the area. So this was trying to fill in some of the gaps of the understanding in terms of the biodiversity up there.
Great.
And so what happened was, like a lot of volunteers, but of those, not myself, who have no kind of scientific training or knowledge, but also a lot of like a couple of dozen people, 24, like a good 20 people there were very experienced scientists, land care research scientists who are leading in their fields in terms of like insects, butterflies, wetland plants, wetland ecosystems, things
so
like that.
So what were you specifically doing up there? Like how did
okay,
your day
so basically
work?
I think what was happening, you know, for the flora, for example, the flora teams, which is like the shrubs, the tussocks, the wetland plants, it's really going through and doing a very detailed audit of what's there with some we need to provide detailed lists of the different types of composition we have up there, you know, which is like it's a mosaic of wetlands, tussock lands, rock plateaus. And so it was just providing a very detailed audit of what is there. And because, you know, trying to get 12 experts in wetlands in one place at one time is such a coup, you can really come up with an extremely detailed description of what's actually there. And that applies to fauna as well, which is like, you know, all the cockroaches, snails, butterflies, and also, you know, the open islands, green forest gecko.
Mm. So what was the highlight of your experience grobbing about in knee-deep in water?
I think the highlight was grovelling around in knee-deep water. I think it was quite fascinating to be working with scientists. I kind of had the fortune or misfortune on my first day to be working in a very small team, myself and three other people, and these three other people were all scientists and leading scientists in wetland botany. So they spent the entire day kind of like talking in Latin to each other and being obviously quite amazed at the total overwhelming biodiversity in terms of the wetland biota and biodiversity. I mean, for someone like for a layman or a civilian like myself, it's a little bit over my head, but you know, to see the excitement and the fascination gives you a glimpse at a whole different world. You know, it makes you understand how little you do really understand of the that richness that you get as a scientist, I suppose.
So it's quite a harsh environment, and it used to be used to have a large mine there before. Now it's got sort of a dirt track going over it. What makes the plateau special? Because some people have compared it to the Galapagos and say that it's a very, very fragile environment. Why should we be protecting the Denniston Plateau?
I think it's... The thing about Denniston Plateau is it's not like a North Island rainforest or fiordland where you've kind of like got a lot of megaflora and megafauna. It's very much a subalpine west coast wetland plateau, and it's essentially stone shelving on a very, very large coal plateau. So there's extremely little nutrient in the soil, and because it's very exposed to the west coast environment, and it's being subalpine, so like a lot of the time it's covered in snow, it creates a uniquely harsh environment, and uniquely harsh environments produce unique flora and fauna. And this is what exists up there, is, and also very predator free. So you've got like giant snails, got Poelophenta patrinus, and you know you've got like giant tree wetters, and you've got a lot of bonsai rata and bonsai flora shrubs and tussocks that have evolved in total isolation to the general kind of like South Island climate and environment. So I guess if you're talking about unique environments and undamaged complete ecosystems, this represents a unique undamaged ecosystem that contains unique flora and fauna. And purely, you know, I mean, as they say, you know, how many rivets do you want to take out of a plane before it falls apart? I mean, how many diversities do you want to like destroy and make extinct before the whole system starts to collapse under pressure and under stress? So I think, you know, as part of our commitment to maintaining biodiversity, if there is such a commitment, then this would be the first place to start, you know. And I would have to say, I mean, I don't want to kind of like ramble on too much, but that's only one of the issues here. You know, there's larger issues as well. There's the issues of like, what the hell are we doing mining coal in the 21st century anyway? You know, if you're not obviously there'll be like the fringe lunatic climate deniers, but if you accept that generally we're kind of on the path to creating a hell on earth with climate change, you know, like one of the big contributors to CO2 in the environment is coal burning. And if you want to burn coal, well, then you're going to have to really buy into the whole fact that we're going to change this planet for the worse. And that's going to be impacting on our children and our grandchildren and future generations. And people really need to accept and get on board with that change, you know.
Nonetheless, there is money to be made in coal. I mean, if nothing else, people will get wages from working in the coal field. So, you know, should we also be looking after the, you know, economic interests of people who might potentially want to work?
That's a good question. I think one of the really fascinating things about Denniston is, like I was saying before, it's like quite multi-layered, not only in terms of its you know, its biodiversity and its plants, etc., etc., but also it has these political and financial layers that are very intriguing as well. And one of those is, okay, if you want to like take climate change, coal burning, coal extraction, strip mining of biodiversities, destruction of biodiversities, put those to one side. Let's look at Denniston as a financial calculation with no consideration of the future impact. What the hell are we doing bringing in a Merrill Lynch, Wall Street-owned multinational to mine New Zealand coal for like a pitiful royalty? Right now, we have a state-owned enterprise called Solid Energy that's quite happily and successfully strip mining the Stockton Plateau, which is a few minutes north of Denniston, making millions and millions and millions of dollars that go straight into the government coffers. And yet, all of a sudden, the national government and John Key have decided that Merrill Lynch, a Bank of America owned multinational, are going to come in here. They're going to like swoop under a state owned enterprise and grab the coal mining licenses for the Denison Plateau. Well, where do you think all that money's going to go? I mean, sure, it's quite likely that the 200 hectare, the initial application for the 200 hectares at the Escarpment Mine will go ahead. We can, that's probably inevitable. I don't want to be giving up on the first, the first course. But if you accept that's going to happen, it's going to happen by Bathurst Resources. Why isn't it being mined by our own state-owned enterprise that's very, very capable of strip mining valuable biodiversity areas for coal? And that'll give employment to the local West Coast economy, and it will put money back into the government coffers, not back into the coffers of Merrill Lynch and Bank of America.
Right, and so where to from here for people who, how do you see yourself as being involved in this in the future? I think Forest and Bird want to set up a reserve in that area. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's like really a lot of credit to Forest and Bird that they accept, or not accept, but that they've kind of like taken the initiative in terms of like, okay, it's on one hand you can oppose applications to mine. On the other hand, it's really important to provide credible and significant alternatives. And I think that the Forest and Bird initiative in terms of like applying for this whole coal measure, as it's known, which is the coal plateau on that west coast north of Westport, to be put into a national park, is taking the initiative in terms of like, okay, well, not only are we opposing the mining for all these different reasons, but here's our suggestion, here's our proposal to actually put this biodiversity into a national park, and put it on the same legal footing as Mount Aspira National Park or Fiordland, it is in that league,
And I believe it's the last unmined Southland Plateau as well. I mean, because Stockton was one.
Well, it's not Southland. It's
South Island. Sorry.
Right. Basically, on the west coast in the north of Westport, there's like what they call a coal measure, which is like this large subalpine plateau that's composed primarily of the Denison and Stockton plateaus joined together, and there's Mount William and Mount Augustus, etc., and they represent, as I was explaining before, the unique biodiversity, was it's essentially a 6 metres of rainfall a year onto a stone composite on a coal plateau. So you get this incredibly nutrient deficient, harsh environment. And so half of that coal measure or coal plateau is right now and has been strip mined by Solid Energy up at the Stockton mine, and this represents the second half of that plateau.
One of the issues that concerns me is that the Denniston Plateau is public land, and therefore it should be publicly notified if the mining is to go ahead, and yet the Minister of the Environment has now said it will not be publicly notified. And so I think part of our natural resource is that we need to protect it for the use of future generations. And one of the things that concerns me is that you turn something that's a beautiful environment into an open cast mine, which generates profit for an overseas company who have agreed to rehabilitate the land when they leave. But first of all, it's almost impossible to rehabilitate land that's been open cast mined. And secondly, experience shows that once things have been mined and the resource has been taken, there's really no incentive to go on spending money to rehabilitate it. I do think that's one of one of the things that I've heard people say is that in a sense ordinary New Zealanders need to stand up for the for the rights of the land and our right to have it as an undisturbed natural resource, and unless we do that, we're going to lose all the things that make us famous and that we value as New Zealanders, which is that clean green image.
Absolutely. And I would just like to say, in terms of the Bathurst Resources application to strip mine Denniston Plateau, It's the beginning of a tsunami. I mean, the submission paper that was released in 2010 by the National Party for removal of Category 4 land, which is Category 4 conservation land, is like Mount Aspira National Park. This is like the creme de la creme. This is like the best conservation, the most beautiful land, conservation land in New Zealand, and it has a Category 4 rating, which means it's protected from mining. So basically what the National Party want to do is remove, and some of that land has the misfortune of sitting on large streams of coal and gold, other rare metals as well. And so the National Party, in terms of like trying to save our economic disaster, want to remove some of our best land from that Category 4 protection. And so I think, you know, with the whole massive hunger for coal and resources, that's kind of starting to pick up momentum with China and India coming into the, you know, new world order, you're going to see a lot of pressure coming on New Zealand. Not, and Denison's just the beginning. You know, we're talking about offshore drilling for oil. We're talking about offshore drilling for gas. We're talking about more mining in the Coromandel for coal, for gold. The mining of the iron ore beds off the north, the west coast of North Island. There's going to be an absolute tsunami of mining that's going to start breaking on New Zealand, and people start need to be starting to think about that and becoming aware of that, and also becoming aware of the economic repercussions if all this mining, which is supposed to be like, you know, the economic saviour for New Zealand, if all that's going to be done by multinationals who are employed by Merrill Lynch, ex-employee of John Key, to do that mining and strip mine not only our coal and gold, but strip mine all that money and take it overseas. These are really important issues, away and above and above and beside the issues of mining conservation land and biodiversity, and also, like, you know, coal and its addition to global warming.
Mm. So if you want to find out more about this, how can you find out what Forest and Bird are doing or some of the initiatives?
Well, I mean, really just use your fingers and go to Forest and Bird website or Coal Action Network, both two teams that are very onto this issue specifically, and also these issues in a big general sense, you know, in terms of like what's going to start happening in New Zealand across the board, you know. And that's also obviously with the lignite mining in Southland.
Mm. Lovely. Well, you've been listening to Hugh Ross, who's been talking about the mining the Denniston Plateau and his experiences in the Bio Blitz that was organised by Forest and Bird a couple of weeks ago to find out what kind of flora and fauna are endemic to that area. Thanks very much, Hugh.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7pm and Thursdays at 12:30pm. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.